Hi everyone, Dom Famulao here, and I love that Vader introduction with the quality of how sticks are made. Today, from Breaking Benjamin, we have got the great Sean Foyce. Please welcome Sean. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. How are you, man?
Sean, I am doing fantastic, man. I really get a kick out of watching a lot of the video and stuff that you have done, and you really are an absolutely 100% committed player to every note you play, to every song you play, and to every show you perform. You are in it big time.
Wow. Coming from you, that means a lot. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I mean, listen, you're out there inspiring people. You're out there doing it. And you're really kind of lifting the standard of our art form because of your commitment of what you're doing. This is really huge. This really is very important.
I believe that's important. You know, anytime I've ever taken to stage, I play that show like it's the last show I'm ever going to play in my life. So from start to finish, that show gets my all every night.
Well, I tell you, it comes across because, I mean, you're given all that you have at that moment. And listen, the audiences are screaming and yelling, so they're feeling it. So what you're doing is working.
Well, I hope that it's working. You know, sometimes you get that one guy in the audience just kind of doing this, and then later you see him in the meet and greet, and he's like, "You were awesome." And it's like, "Oh, God, I thought you hated me. You look bored. You look not impressed." But you got to remember, some of those people are just like in awe of what's happening. So it can get in your head.
Absolutely. And that's that fan comatose look that sometimes they get when they're there. They're kind of like out of it because they're amazed at what's being given to them. You know, the feeling of live music at that level, it really is powerful. And I know we're missing this now with this pandemic. It's a challenge of what it is. But when it comes back, I really believe it's going to come back stronger than ever.
It's going to be huge. I mean, you're going to have every band fighting to tour and touring all at once. I think they should just do like a huge festival tour with all the bands and have it travel around everywhere. And then that way the fans can see all the bands they want with one ticket and call it a day.
That would have to be a year-long festival.
Yes, which is fine with me because I haven't played a show in a year.
Well, I got to go back to the beginning stages when you first started playing drums. If I'm not mistaken, your dad was a drummer?
Yeah. He had this huge Tama Imperial Star kit that sat in the living room of our house. And, you know, I was like 5 years old. And I would just jump up there and start banging on him. I didn't know what I was really doing. And then he used to sit me up in his lap with a cardboard box and a pair of sticks. And we would watch concerts on TV. And I would just play along with him moving my hands to that. And then I really still didn't quite take a huge interest in it. I still did what any kid would do. And I got into sports. And then around age 10, I was just over the whole thing with sports. And this is a crazy story. I don't know if I've ever told this one. I had a dream one night as a kid that I was on stage with Aerosmith and we were playing Lord of the Thighs. And the reason for that is my dad's band played that song. And I think that's where that dream kind of happened. But I visualized myself playing the song. And I woke up at like 6 o'clock in the morning, ran downstairs to the drum kit and played it. And my mom comes running downstairs and she's like, "What in the world?" And I'm like, "Mom, I just visualized playing it and I can play it." And then from there on, drums was it.
Oh, that is fantastic. Well, listen, having that kind of an influence from your dad and just having a family that supports that is a real, real important, you know, first step.
Yeah, my parents believed in me since day one of drumming. Like, they didn't want me to do anything else as long as I was happy to do that. You know, so if it was sports, fine. If it was racing cars, fine. If it was drums, fine. But the catch was, whatever I decided to do, I had to work on that only. And the second I graduated high school, I got woken up by my mom. She goes, "Get up, time to go to work." And I remember making these ads to looking for a band, like drummer looking for a band. And my dad drove me around to every music store in the tri-state area. And we put those up. And I want to say we auditioned 100 people. And I think 100 of them were asked to leave by my dad. He was acting like my manager at the time. It was really so good. One guy came in and couldn't even play a chord. He just goes, next. Like, just brutal. Just brutal. Quite embarrassing for me. You know, I was still a green kid at the time. You know, I didn't know anything about the music business or anything like that.
That is hysterical. Where'd you live? Where'd you start out growing up from? What was the first?
I grew up in Middletown, Ohio.
Middletown, Ohio. Okay, so you were there. So here you are now, influenced by different bands that were there. Were you hearing different bands that were around the Ohio area?
Yeah, well, I originally, after the whole Aerosmith thing, and my dad found out that obviously I could play naturally, he brought me home some Buddy Rich, back then, VHS tapes. You know, because we had to rewind and play those. So I studied those for a bit. And then I'll never forget it. He knocks on my bedroom door and he's like, hey, son, your school has a talent show. And I said, yeah, I know. I heard about it. He's like, well, why aren't you doing it? And I was like, well, I don't think anybody wants to just hear me bang on drums. And he goes, oh, no, we will take a PA system into that gymnasium and give them a rock show. I'm like, dad, you're crazy. But that was my dad. You know, it was either A or B for him, on or off. So he talked me into performing an Allman Brothers song. And this is actually really crazy to get into this story. We did a version of In Memory of Elizabeth Reed, which is the instrumental version.
Yeah.
And I wanted to say I practiced that darn thing 100 times. And it was a long piece. So then the auditions came for the talent show. And I brought my tape and gave it to the guy. And his name's Bob Evick. And even he might be on here watching this. And he watched it and he was like, that's really long, but I don't care. You're doing it. This is awesome. It was 13 minutes, I think. Something crazy like that. And I played it. I got a standing ovation. And I was like, wow, that's amazing. That's a great feeling, right? So fast forward through a lot of the BS I went through trying to get into a band, you know, from age 17 to, you know, now. My first real job was Greg Allman's daughter from the Allman Brothers band. So quite crazy. And that was 3 years before Breaking Benjamin. And there's another crazy story about Breaking Benjamin. We'll get to that.
All right. So
but, yeah.
What's interesting is, so let's go back now, because you're in school. Were you involved in any of the music programs in school?
Well, after the talent show happened, that's when my band director rushed the stage, basically, after the event was over. And he was like, no marching band, no jazz band, no concert band. Where are you? No one even knew I could play. And I'm like, okay, sure. I didn't know. So he filled it out. I remember he filled it out on my thing for me, handed it to me. He goes, take it in, turn it in. I said, okay. So I started with a concert band. And I couldn't read music or nothing. I knew nothing. I played by ear. So I'm like copying the kid next to me. Like, what does that say? How does this go? I'm like doing all that and learning my way up through that. And then did marching band and then ended up doing jazz and won the Louis Armstrong Award my senior year.
Tell me about that. What was that like? Did you have to audition for it? What was that from?
No, I guess there's only one kid per high school that is eligible for the award, and I was voted for it. And if you go to Wikipedia, there's like a list of notable musicians that have won that, and there's like 14 really big musicians, and then you got my name in there. It's like, I don't deserve that. It was crazy. But then I got asked to join jazz band for Oxford University, and I turned it down. I was like, you know, I really want to be in a rock band. I want to be a rock star. Of course, I got laughed at by everybody because the chances of doing that is like winning the lottery. So I worked my way from the bottom and slept on a lot of couches and ate a lot of sliced bologna. But I ended up getting there.
Well, not only did you get there, but, you know, you won the lottery. I mean, when you think about what you did, your persistence, your dedication, your nonstop energy really pushed forward to make this happen.
Yeah, it was just the work ethic. My mom and dad just instilled that work ethic into me. And, you know, it was either do it or don't. And there's no quitting, you know. You signed up to do it, you're doing it. And that's where it started turning into my playing and learning things. studying drummers, if I didn't learn it correctly, I wasn't performing it.
So who were you starting? What drummers were you starting to listen to at this time? You know, you talk about Buddy Rich, and Buddy Rich is someone to listen to be inspired by, and Buddy's a technical, you know, amazing, you know, freak of nature. Who else were you listening to?
Yes, it was started with Buddy Rich, and then it got into Tico Torres from Bon Jovi. A lot of people didn't realize how much of a monster drummer he was, because he was actually a really great jazz drummer. Studied with Joe Morello. And studied him, and then, of course, I got into John Bonham. I went through a Lynyrd Skynyrd phase, too, which was kind of interesting, but that didn't last too long. And then my dad's bass player came over one day and handed me a CD, and I'll never forget it. The CD, it was a burnt one, and it said, Awesome Drummers. Oh, okay. So I listened to it, and the first thing on it was Digital Man by Rush. And I was like, oh, what's this? And immediately I asked my mom to take me to the local record store because I needed to hear more. And I bought my first Rush album, which was Exit Stage Left, the live version. And that was it for me. My drumming life had changed. And I studied that man and still do to this day. And that's my all-time biggest influence to date.
Well, it's pretty amazing to see the influence that Neil had, not only on past generations, but generations to come. I had the chance of meeting Neil and a couple of times, and he was just an incredible, dedicated player that was also a continual student. And I think that's something which people have to kind of understand about the greatness of Neil Peart, is that he was constantly seeking knowledge and taking lessons, you know, almost up to the end of his life. He was studying with Peter Erskine.
Yeah, imagine being that guy and being the teacher, being Peter or being Freddie Gruber, and having the world that calls him the best drummer in the world walk in and say, I want lessons. You know, imagine being the teacher, like, well, what do you want to learn? But like Neil, I mean, he also knew, just like any smart musician does, that you don't know it all and you're constantly evolving. And he always wanted to make his craft better, or he would take it from here to here. And that's what I'm currently doing. I'm reinventing my playing too, and trying to be the best that I can possibly be. And that just makes us better all around. Study all types of music, listen to other drummers, take lessons, you know, do it all.
Absolutely. But this is what we call an open mind. And I always say the mind is like a parachute. It only works when it's open.
Correct.
An important part of the process. It sounds like you have an incredibly open mind to listen to all those different drummers and players. And listen, Neil is still influencing generations. And it's been a little over a year that we've lost him, and he's still, you know, on the tip of everyone's tongue when it comes to drumming. So that's something which I think is a great message to send out to all the different listeners.
Yeah. For anybody listening, study all styles of music, even if you do not like it. So let's say you're huge into rock and roll. Study jazz, study Latin. You can actually incorporate those different musical pieces into your rock and roll later. And I didn't find that out until I started getting into the studio at a really young age and having producers like, hey, give me a little bit of a Latin ride cymbal thing right there. And you'd be like, oh, I got that tool in the toolbox. Let me pull that out and use that. So that really became important. And I'm so glad that I did that. And I learned that from an old Tico Torres instructional videotape where he said, learn all styles of music and keep an open mind. Those were his exact words. And as a young kid, my brain was a sponge. I listened to it and I took that and did exactly that. And it paid off later.
Well, that's fantastic. You know, I remember that video with Tico. Tico is a dear friend. And I had helped him with that video. He mentioned my name on there as a thank you. It was amazing because, and I remember telling him when he was doing this, I said, Tico, you know all styles. I said, that's a part of his greatness of how he is. He can pull out all styles. And again, his toolbox was loaded.
Yeah. Like, and people don't even realize it. Like, drummers on here, go watch Tico. That guy's a freak.
Yeah. And a great guy too. So in this area, so now you start. So when you came out of high school and you started to play with bands, what was the first, you know, biggest or first, you know, professional gig that you started to latch on to?
Okay, so we talked about the music store deal and getting ads. So we found one guy that we thought was really good, and he found some other guys that we thought were good, and we formed this band. And I'm 17 years old out of high school, and I move to Atlanta, Georgia, because we are going to now do a record down there in a place called Tree Sound Studios. And we recorded there, we were about to record there, and the producer's like, you know, this drum set, you know, what are you using? And it was, you know, my dad's old school Tama kit. And they were like, you know, we really wish you had some, you know, something a little nicer. And I told my mom about it, and she immediately got me a brand new DW drum kit. That's how much she believed in me. Like, no BS, just put me in the car and went, and we got it, took it, and we did that session. And I just remember, and this was like where, like, what I call the brick wall happened. We started recording, and the producer's like, okay, how do you want your click? I'm like, what are you talking about? What click? And I knew what a metronome was. I didn't know they called it a click. So he starts putting this thing in my ear, and I start trying to play to it. Failed. I couldn't play to the thing if I tried. And then the producer's like, you know, this isn't going to work. We can call, you know, a studio guy in. You can, you know, learn. And I said, no, give me till tomorrow, and I'll get it. And I stayed in that studio the whole night. I didn't sleep. I played from that night through the whole morning until I got it. And then next day, cranked out the 5 songs. No big deal. But that was like one of those things, like I wasn't ever formally taught. Because I didn't take formal lessons. I didn't anything like that. I did things old school and just played along to live records that constantly had movement. And so I had to learn that the hard way. So people listening, study a click if you don't, because it's very important in the studio later, and you'll find that out the hard way. So I almost pulled the Kenny Aaron off of, like, losing my first recording session. You know, I don't know if people know that story. And he came out, and he's the greatest studio drummer ever. So that was another part of the don't quit. I could have easily said, yeah, sure, get somebody else and I'll learn it later. But I didn't. I said, no, this is my record. This is my drums. I'm playing.
Well, this goes back to a real testimony to your own personal character, that you didn't want to quit. You wanted to really kind of push yourself. And sometimes learning something means we have to develop change, and we've got to adapt real fast. And it's the time to put our big boy pants on and say, I'm going to make this happen. And you did.
And I did. And I even find now, even in my career now, something every day happens and I have to be on the tip of my toes. And it's like, you got to do this and you got to do it right now. And something you're not used to. So always expect the unexpected. And always, you know, like Neil Peart used to say, preparation meets opportunity. That is true. Prepare yourself for the opportunity that's going to come later, even if you don't think that it ever will. I promise you, it'll happen when you don't expect it to. And it's not fun when it happens when you're not prepared. It's the worst thing ever.
Well, that's a great, great point. And preparation is not only a matter of having the ability of being able to play well and know your instrument well, but it's preparation on how to deal with people. It's preparation on how to travel. You know, when you're on tour, there's a lot of skills we have to have complete to understand success.
Absolutely. 100%.
So the Warped Tour, when did the Warped Tour start? Were you opened up for Alice Cooper and Marilyn Manson?
I did the Picture Me Broken album with David Bendith producing, which David Bendith also did Breaking Benjamin at the time. And I did that record with Picture Me Broken. Got the call for touring with Alice Cooper, which would have been 2012, 13, somewhere around there. Yeah. And we were like maybe a month from that tour starting when the Breaking Benjamin thing kind of surfaced. But yeah, I did the whole, it was like a 3-month tour. It was a long tour. And my dad died in the middle of that, which was a huge bummer. Because, you know, you didn't ever get to see a Breaking Ben show, unfortunately. But, you know, he was just happy to see that I got to play. And he said, you know, I just want to see you play in an arena. And I'm laid up in this hospital. So we took the modern technology of FaceTime, set up my phone so he could see the arena, and got a good mix for him. And he got to see that. And then he passed shortly after. So that was bittersweet.
Well, it's amazing that he was able to be the spark that got you involved with this, and you carry on his memory and you carry on his legacy through every time you hold a pair of sticks in your hand and strike.
Oh, yeah.
Your dad is there.
Oh, he's there. The cool thing, though, is that he did get to hear a couple demos for the Breaking Benjamin stuff because, you know, I got called for Breaking Benjamin before that tour started, but I wasn't allowed to tell anybody about it. So that was another thing of like, who do I tell? I'm getting ready to go on tour, and you fear like losing the gig because you're gone for so long. So that whole thing was just like, it was life-changing in a sense, you know, how that whole thing happened, you know. It was weird.
So tell me about the Breaking Benjamin. How did that all kind of come out? How did those connections kind of
okay
come into the play? And just...
This is going to absolutely blow your mind. I can't make it up if I try. So I was a fan of the band before I was even in. I knew the previous drummer, Chad, and he would invite me out to shows here and there. And I went to this show, and we was in Indianapolis, as a matter of fact. In the crowd, I had my best friend, Nick Teamy, with me. And he looks at me, Dom, and I swear to you, he says, you're going to be in this band one day. I looked at him. I said, you're high. You're out of your mind. Like, no, it's impossible. Like, Chad's great. He's not going anywhere. And I met Ben later that night, and he's like, so what do you do? And I said, well, I play drums. And he just goes, all right, cool. That was it. So I went on about my life. And I'm walking down the sidewalk in L.A. to get a coffee one morning right before the Alice Cooper thing happened. And the producer that did Picture Me Broken and Breaking Benjamin calls. And he said, so how happy are you in your band? And I said, well, I'm happy. You're getting ready to go on like a 3-month tour. And he goes, well, I got this thing, and it might be a band you might have heard of before. It's called Breaking Benjamin. And I said, now, Dan, don't pull my leg. That's not nice. Don't play, you know, don't play games with me. He goes, no, I'm serious. Ben wants to talk to you. And I don't think I made it to get my coffee. As a matter of fact, I turned around and started running down the sidewalk and trying to call my mom and my dad. And then Ben calls and he's like, hey, dude. So, first of all, why didn't you ever tell me you were a great drummer? I'm like, well, first of all, I'm not cocky, and you had a great drummer, and what's the point? And he's like, I saw your drum cover on YouTube, and you're incredible. I want you in my band. I'm like, well, I'm getting ready to go on a 3-month tour. I'll quit right now, though. I'll quit. And he goes, no. You're going to need the experience. Go on that tour, get the arena experience. You're going to need it. I said, okay. So, but you can't tell anybody anything. I'm like, okay. You know, because the band wasn't anybody. You didn't even have a band. So I finished the tour. I quit after the tour and threw all of my drums in the back of a U-Haul pickup truck and drove from Florida all the way to Pennsylvania. Knocked on his door, showed up, set my drums up, and, we played Diary of Jane, I think it was the first song. And he just goes, so do you want it? I'm like, yeah, like the gig? And he goes, yeah, it's yours. And then next thing you know, he's putting this band together. And the next thing you know, we're in rehearsals. The next thing you know, we're playing sold out freaking arenas. We got a number one record. It's gold. I'm like, what is going on? My life went from here to here and a year. It was like a whirlwind. It's a blur.
So at that point, when you got to Pennsylvania, and you did you stay in Pennsylvania? Were you there for a few days or a few weeks, or did you go back?
Oh, no, it was literally, we played the song, and he goes, how long can you stay? And I said, as long as you need me to. I was living with him and his wife for like 3 months. You know, because it was just he and I and a bass player, Aaron, that we have. Playing two stems on, you know, tracks from Pro Tools because we didn't have a guitar player. Yeah. And then they eventually came later, not long after, but really shortly after.
Yeah.
And we all played together and it was just magic. And I was like, yeah, this is it. And it was just meant to be. It was incredible. And then the next thing you know, you're writing a record. And the next thing you know, you're on tour. You're playing all the huge festivals. Your album's number one for however long. I think that single was number one 9 weeks. Yeah. So I'm like, this is crazy.
How did the writing process go? He'd come in with tunes and you guys would work together. Did you offer ideas or opinions?
On that album, he had either the 5-year hiatus where he didn't tour. So he had 5 years to basically write that record, and it was 95% written before any of us came in. The only thing that he really had was kind of some program drum ideas, and he and I sat together and just kind of went through those. But the cool thing about that whole thing, and this is, again, preparation meets opportunity, I was a fan of the band, so I had learned all the past material. I knew the style. I knew what he was looking for. So when he would ask me to do something, I knew what he was talking about with him having to explain it. You know, he'd go, "Do got," and I go, "Yeah, yeah, the ride thing." He'd go, "Yeah." And we immediately formed this relationship working together that was just, it was so tight that it was just so incredible and so easy. No fighting, nothing. And I knew what he thought, and he knew what I thought, and it worked. And then as we kept evolving and doing more records, it got to the point where he was like, "You know, just record something and let me hear what you got." He started putting trust into me. And he'd still come in and tweak it and, you know, put the Ben on it, is what I call it, the Ben touch. And because he's phenomenal. And yeah, just like the way we work together, it literally feels like we've played music my entire life.
Fantastic. How do you figure that kind of chemistry? You know, that's a very rare, you know, harmonious vibration of chemistry that comes in. All of a sudden, you meet people where it just clicks. How do you explain that?
It's hard to explain. You know, I'm sure, like a lot of people that have been in bands where it can get frustrating, you know, if one guy's not pulling the weight, just doesn't care, or doesn't quite understand the style. Hmm. But when you meet that person that you connect with on all levels, friendship, musicianship, that's rare. And a lot of people are like, "You know, Sean, you should play the lottery." I'm like, "Screw that. I've already won that." Because like everybody in the band's friends. There's no fighting. We're all on the same page and we're all like this. It's not just Ben and we're all like this. That's rare. And that's what makes a band last 20, 30 years. Not saying that we're going to last that long, but you know, we're fortunate. Breaking Ben's been at it since, you know, early 2000s and it's still going. That's saying something.
It's still going strong. You know, there's got to be a wonderful mutual respect that you all have with each other to allow that to happen. And that's really a very important foundation for any band or any relationship to continue.
Yeah, that's just it too. We all respect each other's abilities and talents, and we listen to what they have to say. And we respect ourselves as people, not just as musicians. And that's what makes it work. If I can last on a bus with somebody for 3 months at a time, says a lot. Because, you know, a lot of people, that's when you hear these bands that they fight and beat each other up before a show, and then after they're fine and, you know, break up and, you know, like the drama. It's nothing like that with us. Boy, I don't think we've ever had a disagreement.
That's fantastic. All you have to do now is find a wife like that.
Actually, I want to add to the story, too, not to take away from that. I kind of dodged that thing real quick. I pulled the e-brake on you and made a right turn. During, like, the whole when Ben called me thing, he wanted me – I forgot about this. He wanted me to record myself playing to a few more songs. And my manager now, Lonnie, set up the studio space for me to go record this stuff, and she had no idea what was going on. And I'm like, just trust me. You know, I'm setting up drum kits and, you know, making her leave the room. I was like, you can't know what's going on. She goes, "But I'm your like support." And I'm like, "I know I love you, but I can't tell you." And I eventually broke down. I was like, "And if you say anything," so I told her, and she's still my manager today. And she's a big support. And we laugh about that story because that studio's still around and it's in San Mateo, California. It's called Fang Studio, and they had no idea what was going on. All they heard was Breaking Ben blasting and me playing along to these songs, and they're like, "Why is he playing to a band that hasn't been out in 5 years?" You all find out.
Oh, That's fantastic. So 2015, you recorded Dark Before Dawn.
Yeah.
That goes to number one on the rock chart. That hits gold. I mean, it's pretty amazing. So what was it like touring and starting to formulate this new relationship?
Well, it was really weird for me, to be honest, because we were doing a lot of touring with a lot of bigger bands. And actually, your guest coming up soon, Morgan Rose. I'll never forget this because I met Morgan during that cycle. And he's opening for me. That's not right. I saw him when I was 16 years old at a concert in my hometown, and he was like a hero of mine. So it got really weird, and it started getting in my head. But I'll tell you what, like, the thing that really got to me the most, it wasn't the big crowds. It wasn't, you know, the 8 weeks on and 2 weeks off schedule, nothing like that. What did it for me was making the mistake of getting on social media and reading the negativity. Because I came into a band that had a legacy of great drummers. You had Jeremy Hummel, Chad Saliga, and here you got me, a little nobody guy that had no big band, just jumps in there, and they roasted me, man. They were making fun of me, and then it started getting to where, like, I couldn't focus. I'm like, everybody hates me, and it started to affect me mentally and physically, touring, like, because all I'd think about is, like, that guy in the front row hates me. I can tell just by, he's one that's making those comments on YouTube.
Yeah.
It got weird, man. But I eventually started to get over that later in the career. But that was, for me, was the hardest thing, was I wanted to be accepted. And I was only halfway accepted, you know. I was either hated or loved. And that was tough. But I had to remind myself that, you know, everybody's got their favorite. And it'd be the same if I even left and somebody else came in. They'd get it too. That's just how it is. And just had to let it go. Stop reading the negativity and just be positive.
So how do you let it go? Because this, Sean, really is a very common challenge with many drummers and, of course, many musicians, where they start to lose confidence. They start to feel a little bit of the challenges that the internet can give. Some of the comments on the internet, and some of the thumbs down, and just the general negativity. How do you pass that? How do you find the strength to just let it go?
For me, it was, you know, because it started hindering my playing to where it got in what I call in my head.
Yeah.
And then every night that part of the song would come up that I messed up the night before. I go, oh, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. Boom. Just did it again.
Yeah.
And for me, it's just a lot of, I just tell myself I'm here. I was meant to be here. I can do it. And there's thousands of people out there that just want to hear a good time. If there's one guy out there that's miserable and wants to get on the internet and talk, I feel sorry for him because he's just not a happy person. I'm here. I should be happy. And I'm going to give those people that entertainment. And not only that, there was something that happened to me that really put me over the hill for that. I saw Rush on their last tour. And I saw Neil make a mistake. And I went, oh, he's human. But I didn't see anybody saying anything about him. You know, like, well, he can do it. I can do it. So then I started going up on the stage with the mentality of, I'm not perfect. I'm human. I will make mistakes. Who cares? As long as my band's having fun and it doesn't train wreck the show, because there are green light mistakes, yellow light mistake, and red light mistakes. So as long as they're yellow and green light mistakes, we're good. But I don't call them mistakes anymore. I call them new ideas. So, you know, just mentally, you have to mentally get yourself through it. It's not a physical thing. It's mental, 100%.
Well, good for you. Well, that's the Miles Davis quote where he said, there are no mistakes, only unexpected opportunities.
Yes, he did say that. Yeah, just new ideas.
Absolutely.
Yeah, sometimes Ben will go, well, that was interesting. I'm going, yeah, new part. It's really, I bombed it. New part.
But that's important to have that kind of positive, uplifting outlook, because, I mean, listen, it's a tough business. When you're traveling the way you are, man, and doing this, it is not easy to be on the road. And traveling is the hardest part that people don't realize. When you get on stage, oh my gosh, that's the joy in front of it. But it's the getting to the venue. It's the setting up. It's the time that you have to wait. There's a lot that can drain you of energy.
Yeah, I never forget the first time the tour bus pulled up, and I was so excited to get on it. 3 months later, I'm like, I hate this thing. Because, you know, you play your show at 8:30, you're done at 10. You clean up, you go, and you get on the bus, and you relax. And then you hear the bus fire up at 2 a.m. The generator's kicked on. The sound of the tires going down the road. All, you know, every little rock and bump. And then you start, you know, do I trust this driver? Like, is he going to stay awake? And then you start having anxiety about crashing, you know, because, like, you're not in control because you realize I'm not in control of this thing. And I think that's where a lot of musicians get into the drugs to put them to sleep, you know, and the uppers that put them through the show, you know, because you just go through this exhaustion of just this ups and downs. You don't sleep, and then you go to play and you don't have the energy. And I'm not saying I did any of that because I've never been a drug user, but, you know, I did get to a point in my life where I went through a terrible breakup and started drinking more than I should have and started caring less about myself as I should have and put on a lot of weight and then started having back problems. And, you know, I think I'm fortunate for this pandemic, even though it's terrible. I'm fortunate for it because I was able to get time to find myself and reform my plane, get stronger and get the weight off and get my life in order, because during that hard part of my life, I was on tour through it all. I didn't have time to get my mind clear. So what I'm telling everybody is the mind's so powerful, it can really destroy you too. So, you know, you got to keep your mind clear. And don't lose yourself, you know, find yourself.
Boy, great advice, Sean. You know, it really is important for people to kind of to heed these words. I mean, you're on the road. You've got the experience of traveling. You've got the experience of having to maintain a high level of performance every performance.
Every time.
You got to be up at the top of your game every performance to maintain that. Those are life issues that we have to keep in balance.
Yeah. And then when you start, you know, having physical problems. And, you know, like with me, I set this bar, like, here's where I have to be. And then when you get a physical injury and all of a sudden that bar puts you here because you can't help it, then your mind starts going, I can't do it. I can't do it. I can't do it. And, you know, like, we're really not quite sure how I'd form my back injury. I have an idea. And I think a lot of it's because I stopped working out, because I started touring so much that I was so like, I don't need to work out. I play 2 hour shows every night. I'm good. I'm in shape. And then, you know, I got older. You know, I started this band when I was 29. I'm 37. Now I'm having back problems. And so, you know, just don't get lazy. Don't ever get too comfortable in your own skin, and don't ever feel like you're, you know, powerless or, you know, going to live forever, I should say, and nothing's ever going to happen, because things happen, and when they happen, it can really put a damper on your playing. So keep yourself in shape, and you know, watch the alcohol on the road, stay more hydrated, and try to eat as good as you can, because, you know, you're putting your body through a lot of trauma. You know, you got your joints, shoulders, your knees, wrists, you know, even your muscles, your back. Like, we as drummers take abuse. And, you know, we're athletes.
Yeah.
You know, so treat your body like your instrument, as your vocalist says. We have to do that too.
Yeah.
I'm not preaching to you guys. I'm sure there's a lot of younger kids laughing like, oh, yeah, my back's fine. I'll just wait till you're about 40.
Well, listen, 37. You're still doing great. You're young at 37. Yeah. I think I may have underwear older than you, and that's a whole nother discussion. That somebody
Well, you look fantastic. I would have guessed 27.
Hey, the key thing is, you're right, keeping yourself in shape and still having the love for music, but it's also about being a constant student, about always trying to learn and be aware of what's happening. Are you listening to anything now with, you know, different drummers or bands now that are keeping you inspired?
You know, all of my inspiration still stems from classic drummers that I grew up listening to. Like, I'm not really into the new wave music, and it might be a mistake on my end. I try to keep an open mind still, you know, but I still go back to here lately. I've been actually going back to day one and starting over and learning the things that I kind of skipped over. So, you know, back to more rudimentary stuff. Yeah. And I actually stay at a studio in Orange County with Harley DeWinter, who plays for a band called Diamante. We toured together, and kid's 23, and he's like a book with, you know, stickings. So I'm like, hey, what was that? You know, and I catch myself kind of stealing from him, you know. So we work together and do stuff. And then when I did the Neil Peart tribute, oh my gosh, I was like, can I even go back and remember any of this? You know, because I learned it when I was 13 and 14 years old. And I started to learn quickly that as we get older, it's actually harder to retain things or even learn or remember. So that was challenging. So now I'm actually just, I'm revisiting a lot of the more difficult, challenging music. Even like listening to stuff like Mahabnis New Orchestra with Billy Cobham.
Yeah.
You know, Tony Williams, Fred. I mean, listen to that track. I mean, stuff like that just to keep you, you know, out of your box. So I take something I cannot play and go, that's what I want. And if you work for it and then you get that, then you find that you become a better player. And then when you go back to the things that you play all the time, that gets better. It's weird how that works.
But that's the constant student that I see in you. You have an ability of being able to keep your mind open to learn. That's that constant learning.
Constant.
Yeah, and that will always deliver success. That'll always deliver success.
Yeah, anytime I've been on tour with any band, I'm like, show me something. Like we were out with Ray Luzier a couple times, and I'm like, hey, dude, how much for a lesson? You know, because that guy, he's just an alien. He's so good. But I, you know, I study those drummers side stage, you know, Morgan Rose, study side stage, you know. Another one that I really enjoyed was Scott Phillips from Alter Bridge.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, just like monster players. And I take these little pieces from these guys and then I go home and try to remember those and then make them my own. So I'm basically stealing. You know, that's what good musicians do. We steal from everybody else and then try to change it to make it ours and take the credit. Sorry.
And that's the formula. We all do it. We all continue to do it. And that's how, you know, I say, you know, we use steel to sharpen steel, but it's man that sharpens man.
Yes, exactly.
As we listen to each other, we take, we adapt, we apply it in our own way, and it works tremendously. Now, you put together the Foyst Drum School, which I think
I did.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
In that, you're sharing ideas and what you're doing, and people can always track you down on your YouTube channel, which is, you know, your name, Sean Foyst. So, I mean, if people can go track that down and hear tons of video that is there. So in the school itself, you know, are there any things you would show someone like a beginner? What would you tell a beginner student what they need to learn or what they need to have, the tools, the skills?
Sure.
What you've achieved.
You know, I take each student differently. You know, the first thing I do, I say, what are you into? And they'll give me like a couple bands and I go, okay. And then I'll have them play for me and like kind of watch how they play. But mainly the first thing for me is all about these and how you hold them and stickings, subdivisions, not the Rush song subdivisions, subdividing quarters, eighths and 16th notes. So if I can, I will move this down.
Yeah, now we're talking.
And this is very basic, you guys. I mean, this isn't like an advanced thing by any means. Let me see if I can put the mic over here and you can still hear me.
Great.
So I just take your standard, your quarters. That's quarters and your eighths. And then I'll start trying to do different stick patterns with the 16s. So like you got your, and just start doing different accents with that. And it's better to have it actually on a click so you can do those. And just practice all different speeds, you know, take it real slow, speed it up. Because the cool thing about those is you can take those and put them around your kit. It's like if you're doing paradiddles too, So you have a right, left, right, right, and a left, right, left, left. Well, it doesn't have to be just one drum. You can put it around the kit, you know, with the different accents. So if you got a right, left, right, right, it could be two crashes, left, right, left, left. That could be another crash or a tom. So you can literally make your rudiments cool around the kit. And so I show people stuff like that. And then I also try to show them groove because of Ghost Notes. I'm actually big into Ghost Notes, and people don't really know that because Breaking Benjamin is not really known for Ghost Notes. But if you take just like a Back in Black AC/DC type of song and you're... I kind of try to teach people to make things what I call groove. It's not as sterile. So what I mean by that is like this. It's kind of sterile, but if you make it a little... a little more groovy, it makes it more interesting.
Beautiful, beautiful, Sean. Yeah. That really shows... you know, and what you're saying, that really kind of shows a way of being able to add more personality to the feel of the groove by adding those ghost notes in. And those ghost notes, those small little subtle notes in between the major notes, really kind of add to like a forward motion to the feel of the tune.
Yes. And
you do that so well. When I watch you playing, you subtly put these little strokes in there, and maybe they might not be heard, but they're felt.
They're felt.
Huge.
Exactly. You know, Fool in the Rain by Led Zeppelin, or Rosanna, or by Toto. Listen to those two tracks. That's feel. You know, that's just great. And you can incorporate all of that into rock. And if you even listen to like the latest record, listen to the track called Blood. There's a snare ghost note thing happening in the chorus that sounds like I'm playing 16th notes on another track. And I've been asked about that. Like, is that overdubbed? No, it's a ghost note. And it just kind of, it's like swung in a 16th. It's weird. It's really cool. And I like to do things like that just because of the feeling purpose, not really because of anything else. I just like things to move. You know, you have a thing where you can push a click or pull a click, and you can do that with groove.
Yeah.
And it's like to do, you know, things like that.
Boy, it's so great that you have that level of subtlety that you're offering. And also, you know, listen, let's talk about Vader for a second. You're using the Abe Cunningham Cool Breeze model, and I know that, or you'll switch off to like a 5B, but you have the right tool in your hand so you can really kind of, you know, deliver those ghost notes and that control and that groove. Just talk about the sticks that you use.
Yeah, so the Abe Cunningham stick, for those that don't know about it, it's basically, if you took a 5B, which I have a 5B, right here,
yeah,
here standard 5B. The Abe Cunningham is for people that the 5B isn't heavy enough, but a 2B is way too big. So it's in between, and it's a great stick for rock and roll. It still has a good tip on it for articulation on ride cymbals, and it's an acorn tip. And, you know, it's a hickory stick too, and I think it's like 16 to 5/8. In length, but it's, you know, it's a long stick, so good reach, and it's just, it also has what I like in a stick is like when you take a stick, and even the 5B does it for me too, is when I drop it, it just works for me, it just transfers really well, and I can get those with the finger too, the extra hit, yeah. Easy with them, that guy, so it's less effort. And it's just really good balance. So when I go in the studio, it's a little heavy. So I don't really get the articulation of ghost notes as well as I would like. Or, it, you know, things are just, I guess, too heavy on cymbals because it's a big rock stick. So for certain tracks, I might even go down to a 5A. Or I've actually gone down to a Fusion model, too, for a song called Ashes of Eden. On Dark Before Dawn. It sounds like Hot Rods, but it's actually their Vader Fusions on that track. And you know, just different tools, like different sticks do different things. Even nylon tips do different things. If you want a little brighter cymbal on your ride, you know, there's all kinds of cool things.
And it could be just a sound you're looking for from a live performance or a studio date.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know, I'll take a whole different bag of sticks into a recording session with any band. That way I have it. Every band has a sound. You know, and Abe Cunningham, if you want to go in and just, you know, be loud, like, okay, yeah, that's the stick. That's a good one, or a 2B. If you want to be a little more, you know, jazzy, little bebopper, like, get a Fusion, you know, or just try different things. It doesn't hurt. I know some guys that use two different sticks, and I've done it. I've had a 5B on my right hand and a 5A in my left. And if the snare is just too heavy.
Boy, how beautiful. Just to have that level of understanding that you've got in your stick bag, you've got a variety of Vader tools for different, you know, realizations and situations. And this is great to have everyone that's listening to you to kind of be involved with what's happening so they can get involved. I think we have a question to come up. Let's bring up a question.
Yeah, questions are good.
From Chris Foti. What's up, Sean? Tell the story of Morgan and Decker messing with your kit on ship on Shiprock. That took down the cymbals in the middle of Sean playing on stage. Ben was like, what the hell are you guys doing? What was that about?
Okay, so for everybody that knows, Morgan's a really close friend of mine. So is Decker. And there's an old touring prank that likes to be played on drummers. And it's always done, mind you guys, the last song of the set. And they come up and take your cymbals and drums off. Marilyn Manson did it to me one night. But anyways, we were doing Shiprocked. We're maybe the third or fourth song in, and we were playing Ashes of Eden, a slow ballad. And they came up and started taking my drums off. So Ben, literally, the song ends. Ben turns around and goes, you know, you guys are supposed to do that on the last song, not the fourth, right? You know, like, that's just the jokers they are. They don't care. So they took the trick, and it's like, we're doing it in the middle of the whole show. And that was fun. But they were nice enough to leave me enough to finish the song. Marilyn Manson left me with a splash and a snare. So he really did me in. But he waited till the last song.
Now, I've got a very deep question for you.
Okay.
You gotta make a choice between two things, a Ferrari or a Lamborghini.
I'm a Ferrari guy all day. My favorite's the 488 GTB. That's my car. Like, if I could have any car, that would be the one. Lamborghinis are cool, but there's just something about a Ferrari, and it has to be red. I don't know if it's a Ferris Bueller's Day Off thing for me, but it has to be Ferrari red.
Fantastic. I know you're into drag racing, man. You're really into the whole yeah, car, which is a whole nother, you know, thing that is a great outlet that also is equally as intense and creative, much like the music industry.
Yeah, it's dangerous, and I always say that I drive fast cars, I tour, you know, like, something's going to happen at some time, you know, like, but so far I've been good. You know, I stay away from motorcycles, though, for that reason. You know, I know what I do on four wheels. I don't want to know what I would do on two. But yeah, I do a lot of the competitive quarter-mile drag racing. I have a 2019 Mustang that makes 1,400 horsepower. Ish somewhere around there, and beautiful. You know, quarter mile, 160 plus.
Beautiful. And,
it's scary, but you know what? My singer hates it. He's like, "No, you're done. Don't do that. You know, you're gonna get hurt." So I don't do it very much anymore. But that's been a passion of mine. My dad was in the racing. My mom was in the racing. So you know, it's one of the things that gets passed down.
And beautiful. You
know, yeah.
What do you say to a young drummer who's working a day job? Mm-hmm. They're working a day job, and they're working a job that they don't necessarily like, but they have this dream that they want to someday be in a successful band. What's the reality of going from that day job to Glow Tours?
Okay. Well, actually, to that person, I did the day job thing for a while. I worked at a Guitar Center store. I was an assistant manager, and I was later, this is right before Picture Me Broken, and I was offered store manager, and I was offered a really good salary for a 20-some-year-old kid. I think it was like $100,000. I said no. And I said, I'm going to be in a rock band, and I want a tour, because I knew that if I took that job, I was giving up my dreams, and I was stuck at the 9-to-5 forever. And to that person that's, you know, doing the day job, and you really, if you believe in it, and you really want to do it, focus on only that. Leave the girls behind. Leave the cars behind. Leave the drugs behind. Play music. Have no bills. Don't go out and get yourself in debt. And just focus on that. Play with as many people as you can. Play with all the musicians. Meet people. You know, get out. And not right now. The pandemic's happening later. But, just get your social media. I didn't have social media back in the day. I wasn't able to reach millions of people at the push of a button. These kids coming up now have all this power. And you see all these YouTube kids, you get millions of views. You know, they're great players. And they're going to have a future. You know, so stick with it. No pun intended. And you got to stay focused. You have to. Or you're just going to get sidetracked. And if you do drums 2 days a week and, you go out and you do something else for 3 days a week and you go do something else, it lessens your chances of hitting it. You know, if you do this 7 days a week and work on that, it's going to happen eventually.
Yeah.
You know, you have to do it.
Boy, good for you, Sean. Great, great advice. And I want everyone to know that Sean Foist on YouTube, go out and check the YouTube channel. Go there and see some great, great playing video that Sean Foist has on that. Sean yeah. Foist Official is the Facebook page. And Sean W. Foist is your Instagram page, right?
Correct.
Fantastic, man. I want everyone to go by there. Check it out. If you want any information, lessonsbyfoist@gmail.com, track him down. Listen, anyone that's out there, grab some time with Sean. You're going to have a great, great journey. You're going to learn a lot. You're going to be inspired, and you'll be prepared for you to become that next generation of great drummers. Sean, I thank you so much. You have been fantastic to have some time with you. Safe travels. Happy New Year. And I look forward to seeing you in person.
Same to you, brother. It was a real honor to be on here with you. I appreciate you.
Thanks so much. Sean Foist, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Fantastic.
Boy, this is so great to have this kind of time with these great artists like this here. And Sean, as you can see, is a very dedicated player. He's sincere, he's humble, and he's hardworking. He puts his nose to the grindstone and makes it happen. It's really incredible to see the great thing. So when the band gets back out again, Breaking Benjamin, when they get back out again, go there, track them down, go to the concert, and try and get a hold of Sean for sure, just to be able to enjoy some of his great, great personality. February 16th, you got to join us. This is going to be great. Abe Cunningham, Roy Mayorga, Morgan Rose. We've got these three great, intense, heavy hitter players that are going to come on. This will be a roller coaster ride. So I highly suggest when you come in and tune in on February 16th, make sure you have a seatbelt on your chair so you don't fall out of your freaking seat, because this is going to be absolutely great. We'll talk about all different things, about just the physical energy that it takes to maintain what these great players do. That'll happen on February 16th. On February 2nd, oh my gosh, we're going to bring in Fred Elchingham, who's a phenomenal drummer, and joining us will be Sheryl Crow. So I think this will be great to have that opportunity to see how these great artists work together, what Sheryl needs when she's on stage. It's really fantastic to have this opportunity. Vader brings this for us. It's incredible to have this opportunity. Tuesdays at 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. I am Dom Famulara. I'm having so much joy doing this here. You all have been great. Stay well, stay safe, and I hope to see you all soon, but I'll for sure see you next week. Thanks so much.